We're always hearing or reading things about entrepreneurs trying to improve the lives of people in developing countries with new technologies. But many of these expensive initiatives often fail or have unforeseen effects. Water pumps break down from poor maintenance, or farmers abandon new varieties of crops, or mosquito nets that are given to people to protect them from malaria end up getting used as fishing nets instead. Our next story is about an effort to help the rural poor in Nicaragua and the lessons that two American brothers learned while working there. Here's Eliza Barclay with that story.
Matthias Craig is an engineer and social entrepreneur. He's obsessed with windmills.
To me, they seem a perfect mix of an opportunity to do something that has sort of a social good and an environmental good.
As a child, Craig spent a lot of time in Nicaragua, visiting impoverished villages that had no electricity. Later, as an adult, he got an idea. Why not bring windmills to these villages? The windmills could provide clean power and help people escape poverty by lighting schools and health clinics and creating jobs. Craig explored this idea as a graduate student at MIT.
I took a class called Entrepreneurship in the Developing World. So I combined that with my interest in Nicaragua from my childhood and came up with Blue Energy.
Blue Energy is a company Craig founded in 2004. He started it with his brother, Guillaume. Guillaume Craig now oversees the company's headquarters in the town of Bluefields on the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua.
We started here in this workshop. It's about 30 feet by 40 feet deep. So that was our space for like the first couple years.
Guillaume Craig walks around the cavernous building where Blue Energy's technicians build wind turbines. He points to a turbine inside.
It's got the magnets and the copper coils, and it's got a some lights that light up.
When the brothers arrived here, they had their work cut out for them. 80% of the coastal population lacked electricity. The Craigs installed their first wind turbine in 2005, and since then they've added 11 more. Gradually, they're reaching the forgotten outposts of the Nicaraguan coast, places like Monkey Point. In this tiny community, a spindly white windmill towers above the mango trees and fishing boats. Last year, Blue Energy installed the wind turbine and a handful of small solar panels. Together, they produce about half the energy consumed by a typical American home. But here, it's enough to power 27 households, a school, and a health clinic, at least for part of the day. Locals appreciate the electricity. Jorgina Marque is a young mother of two.
Before we were using candles. Everyone did. Now it's better that we have light. I use it to cook and to make the beds in the evening.
But the arrival of electric power has not transformed this community in quite the way the Craig brothers had hoped. The town is still poor, and jobs are scarce. And if you talk to locals and ask them, what's the best thing about having electricity? Here's what they'll tell you. Television.
We've had a lot of debates internally about that.
Matthias Craig says promoting TV was not why he and his partner started their venture.
Definitely some people within the organization, within Blue Energy, were a bit frustrated, you know, a little bit disappointed that they had worked so hard to bring sort of development and opportunity to the community, and here they were using it on television.
Some volunteers who came from America complained about locals frittering away the electricity on TV. In fact, many residents emptied their small savings to buy televisions to watch soap operas. The Craigs learned a lesson. They can't dictate how people use the energy they bring. Now, Monkey Point residents contend television is educational. Wayne McLean, who manages the windmill, says TV helps kids develop their language skills.
The children then could come and watch TV and develop their mind even with one word or one letter of the alphabet.
But whether or not television is an ideal use of the electricity Blue Energy provides, the Craig brothers say they've learned another, deeper lesson. People in places like Monkey Point need many things: good roads, clean water, education, and these may be more important than electricity. Guillaume Craig conceded this point over beers at a bar in Bluefields.
Their priorities are not always energy. Sometimes they're drinking water because they're getting sick and the children are dying from diarrhea. But we don't impose now energy as the what we do.
The what we do of Blue Energy is now much broader. The Craig brothers have turned their energy company into an organization that takes a holistic approach to poverty. Matthias Craig says he now understands that alleviating poverty is much more complex than installing windmills.
When you come at it from a technology perspective, you think your end goal is you build the system, you install it, and it delivers energy. And you do that, and then you get to the end of the path, and then you realize that that's not actually the end of the path. That's somewhere near the beginning of the path.
The new beginning of the path is asking people what they need before deciding what to give them. And that's something the Craigs are just learning to do. For The World, I'm Eliza Barkley, Bluefields, Nicaragua.
The Craig brothers aren't alone. Many engineers and entrepreneurs who've promoted technological fixes to problems in the third world have seen their projects fail or lead to unintended consequences. And many engineers and development experts now say that it's time to rethink not only how engineers approach such projects, but also how engineering is taught. One person who is making that argument is Anu Ramaswamy. She is an environmental engineer at the University of Colorado, Denver. Anu, welcome.
Thanks, Ritu.
Now, you direct a program on sustainable urban infrastructure. And
yes.
If the Craig brothers were in your program, how would you grade them on their Nicaragua project?
I'm not sure about grading, but we wouldn't have initiated a project without having a series of community meetings. The first step, I guess, that we're missing here is problem definition. And that problem definition comes from the community, or ideally should come from the community.
So you've been working in the field of environmental and civil engineering for nearly two decades now, right?
Yes.
Did you have experiences early on in your career that disillusioned you? Was there a point where you first thought, wait, is this really working? Do I really know what can solve this community's problems?
Actually, I think you've said it better than I have, than I would. We've had that experience about 8 or 9 years back when myself and a group of students that were interested in sustainable community development in, you know, remote tribal villages.
Where? What part of?
A couple of projects. One was in India. Fortunately, we had read up a lot of the development literature that talks about how one does, you know, participatory research, participatory rural appraisal. So, for example, they'd say, never meet with the men and the women together in the beginning. You know, always ask for a separate meeting with the women.
Why is that?
Because they may not express what they really need if they're in a, you know, open community meeting.
Mm-hmm.
This is not always true, but it's often true, and we found that to be true. It seems easy to say, well, you should just talk to the community to find out what they want. But even that isn't easy, right? Because different people want different things, different people express different things.
What were you trying to do, first of all? What was the project?
The project was a renewable energy project, a wind generator project.
Oh, wow.
And it's an interesting coincidence.
Yes.
We had always planned that we would do a site visit before we embarked on any design. A key part of the site visit was the community meeting and sort of really gathering what the community wanted. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we didn't even know that they wanted wind turbines. In fact, that's what came out of the community meeting. And one of the needs that emerged was electricity for flashlights, because they would be going out in the forest late at night, you know, to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted flashlights so they could see where they were going, to keep away from animals. And the other aspect was also, they were also interested in toilets. The experience that we had in these community meetings, and there were two or three of them, were just really inspirational. And they were, you know, they were really the things that sort of emphasized in our minds that this is the most important part of the project, finding out what people want. And what was really interesting is the next year, my students went and installed the turbine in one village, and they had a very interesting experience where they then went to another village to find out what was needed in this other village. And I was not on this trip. I remained in the U.S., but my students had really taken to heart these lessons. So when they went to the other village, there's a classic photograph we have of the six, you know, hamlet leaders who are all men, who were all sitting in a row, and there was this big community meeting with women and children and men and the hamlet leaders who are all men. And when they asked them, what do you want? It seems word had spread that we were good at making wind turbines. And so they immediately said, we want wind generators. And fortunately, my student was really gung-ho on having the separate meeting. So he insisted. And after 4 days, He and another student had a meeting with women, and they expressed entirely different needs. They said water was their biggest need. And it was interesting that after that we had a dialogue with the men, and they came around and they said, oh, well, we just thought this is what you did well and this is what you wanted to hear.
But at the end of the day, technology is still going to be central to the solutions, right?
Yes. But I think how quickly and how effectively those technologies are adopted depends on how engineers in this field interface with society. I mean, obviously, in many of these communities, there's a need, whether it's water, electricity. There's a need for a variety of infrastructures. And so when you're coming in as an outsider to offer assistance, it takes a while to understand how you're interacting with the folks in the community, you know, and who's what, who's setting the agenda, who are you really working with, who are you working for. And those things take a little bit of time.
It sounds incredibly time-consuming.
Yes. And I also think one's got to be, I don't know the right word, but, you know, socially savvy to understand, for example, even something as simple as the women won't express what they really want in some communities. You know, that some people know it intuitively, especially if you've lived in other countries, and some people may not.
How are you training the next generation of engineers, and how is it different from how you were trained 20 years ago?
What's different in our program here, which actually is a very interdisciplinary program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, is the core of the program is understanding that it's not a technology-only solution. It's not a social science-only solution. It's not an entrepreneurship-only solution. It's not a public policy only approach.
But so you're taking multiple approaches.
All of these
them.
Have to come together. And in our program, this is a PhD program. We have four disciplines that have come together in our interdisciplinary program on sustainable urban infrastructure. And these include engineering, architecture and planning, public policy, public affairs, I should say, and health and behavioral sciences. And so the students get an introductory class that introduces them to really very core concepts across all these disciplines. Mm-hmm. And then it's followed up with a team-taught class. It's called Defining and Measuring Sustainability. And we work with a local city right here in Colorado to learn some of these participatory approaches and community engagement strategies, and then to do some quantitation, you know, some technical strategies on what the community wants.
So I know of one other program at Columbia University's Earth Institute that sort of takes a similar interdisciplinary approach. Would you go as far as to say that there is a small and growing movement of engineering educators trying to change things and do things in a different way, in ways that are more effective and sustainable?
I believe so. There's a number of universities with really innovative programs. I believe the MacArthur Foundation has understood and articulated this need, and it's called the Masters in Development Practice. Mm-hmm. And that program is trying to seed several universities with this interdisciplinary MDP, Masters in Development Practice. And separate from that, there's engineering education that's being changed, mm-hmm. going out of the box from saying, you know, you're given X, calculate Y. It's just a completely different paradigm from saying, given X, Y, and Z, you know, this is how our questions were. Given X kilograms of this and so much of that, tell us, you know, Q.
Yeah.
And we'd have a formula and we'd calculate it without asking, you know, who wants Q? Really? What's the Q for and who benefits from it? And, you know, what's the broader picture? And it's exciting to be that these curricula are coming about.
Well, Anuramaswamy, it's been great talking to you, and I look forward to continuing this discussion online. You'll be taking questions from our listeners on our Science Forum page through Friday, November 13th. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Ritu.
Have a question for Anuramaswamy? You can bring it to our online discussion at the World Science Forum. Just go to our website, theworld.org/science, and click on Latest Forum.